No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Welcome to the show. Maria, are you there?
I'm here, Mr. Michael, Senator Brown.
It's going to be me and Maria tonight because we have a lot of important stuff to talk about. A lot's going on in the world. And let me start by saying we sent out PR to people saying that we were going to have the former chairman of the Republican Party, Michael Steele, and former lieutenant governor of Maryland on the show tonight. Unfortunately, there was a conflict. He had to be with the governor of Maryland, and there was a little miscommunication, a little conflict, but he's going to be on next week. So please, if you're tuning in now to listen to him, stay for the show because we have some important things to talk about. And I think we want to talk about what we intend to talk about with Lieutenant Governor Steele. So stay with us, but make sure you tune in next week when we have this important guest. If you know Michael Steele, you know that he's on CNN, MSNBC, Morning Joe. He has his own radio show on Sirius XM. So it's going to be great to have him on. And, part of the reason that this show was formed to begin with was to try to reach some common ground in America about issues that are important to all of us. And that's what we're going to talk to Lieutenant Governor Steele about. And Maria and I will talk a little bit about that tonight. But before we get going, let me just say we got two more co-sponsors on our bill this week.
Goodness.
Yeah, not none from California. We may have them all from California. Who knows? But we want to thank Representative, or actually Delegate, Michael San Nicolas, who's from Guam. Now, we should point out that Guam, like the United States, if this comes to a floor vote, Delegate San Nicolas's vote won't count, just like our delegate. But we also have Haley Stevens, who's from Michigan, Michigan's 11th district. So thank you, Representative Stevens, for signing on to the bill.
Do you have anyone from Puerto Rico?
Nobody from Puerto Rico
yet. Interesting. Why is that, do you suppose? Well, have you not really lobbied?
Yeah, no. We've lobbied heavily. And you know what? The resident commissioner. Now, Puerto Rico only has a resident commissioner, which is the equivalent to a delegate without a vote. So there's only one vote you can get from Puerto Rico. But yes, we've been on the resident commissioner's back, and Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's our delegate, was on their bill, the Puerto Rican bill last time. So We really don't get it, you know. And it seemed to me that they were kind of shuffling around at the end of the year, and we never got around to it. So we have to get back to it. But yes, and you know,
well, because I thought they were consulting with you because they didn't need to reinvent the wheel because you have been at it and doing it so well. They were going to kind of follow your prototype, if you will.
Well, that's exactly what they said to us, and I don't know how well we've been doing it, but you know, it's been over 200 years. But the people we met with were actually my counterparts. So we met with the senators and representatives, but, you know, like me, they're not recognized by Congress. So they're not votes that we can get. We met with what, you know, is affectionately called their shadow delegation. And they have they've appointed their delegation. Now, history buffs out there will probably know that United States senators were appointed by governors prior to an amendment to the Constitution, which made it an elected office. So the Puerto Ricans have fallen back to that tradition, and the governor has appointed a delegation, which consists of five, what, you know, is affectionately referred to as shadow representatives, and two shadow senators. There are five shadow representatives because they would get five members of Congress based on their five
population,
based on their population. Yes. So they're all supportive. But the thing that really is important to us about the Puerto Rico bill that was introduced last time is it has eight Republicans on it. And we've met with every Republican on the bill. Don Young, for example, from Alaska, and, you know, and every other Republican on the bill, and basically have tried to lobby them to get on our bill. It's a tougher sell for us because Puerto Rico is seen as more bipartisan than the District of Columbia. They have more elected, you know, the District of Columbia doesn't have one elected Republican. We have 20 elected offices in the District of Columbia, and not one of them is occupied by a Republican. We've never had a Republican mayor. We never voted for a Republican for president, which is kind of amazing. You know, 1961 was the first time we got to vote for president because the 23rd Amendment gave us a vote for president. But we've never voted. When I worked for Jimmy Carter on his reelection, he won Georgia, where he was from, Minnesota, where his running mate was from, and Washington, D.C. Washington has never, ever, you know, even with very popular Republican presidents like Ronald Reagan, they talk about the Reagan landslide. It's not that Reagan won by so many votes, but he won everywhere. You know, he won in every jurisdiction except for Georgia and Minnesota. But he didn't win the District of Columbia either because the district, you know, we voted 92% for Hillary Clinton.
And, wow.
You know, yeah. And what I, wow. Right. You know, my starting joke very often when we speak on this issue is that 92% of her family probably didn't vote for her, you know, because, right. That's what I say about myself. You know, I'm pretty sure Mrs. Brown voted for me, but I'm not positive. 92%, you know, that's just, Reagan certainly didn't get 92% of California, Clinton didn't get 92% of Arkansas, you know, Bush didn't get 92% of Texas. Nobody, you know, that's just an unheard of number. So we're very, very strongly Democrats here in the District of Columbia. Puerto Rico was seen as more bipartisan. They have more elected Republicans. So it's a little easier for them, I think, to get Republicans. There's also another issue, which is money. And that is that the District of Columbia, in the District of Columbia, we not only pay federal taxes, we pay the highest federal taxes in America. In Puerto Rico, they don't pay income tax, and They don't pay taxes on certain types of tourism, and so there's, you know, there's always been a push with some Republicans in Congress to include Puerto Rico because of the whole money issue. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Puerto Rico's not doing well, so I don't know, you know, financially they would probably be a lot of people might see them as a burden financially right now. So I don't know how important that criteria still is, but, you know, it certainly traditionally has played a role. So we're trying to get more Republicans. It looks like, we need 218 members. We got 197 co-sponsors.
Wow.
In the House.
Close. What's the deadline?
No deadline.
Oh, okay. I thought there was a timing.
2020, you know.
Okay.
So the bill would expire. Every new Congress, we have to put the bill in. So the bill would expire. What we're hoping for this time is to get a House vote and a floor vote and a hearing on the bill. Nobody expects it to pass, really. Well, pass in the House, perhaps, hopefully. But, you know, we haven't introduced it yet in the Senate because we're waiting to get some more original introducers. But we assume if it passes in the House, it won't pass in the Senate. And even if it did pass in the House and the Senate, it would have to be signed by the president. So I think our hope is that we get a hearing and we have a floor vote. And then the next time that Democrats are in control of both houses, whether that's 2020, 2024, 2028, whatever it is, that we'll have the momentum to get the bill passed and get it signed. We've never, I'm a superdelegate, which means that I can give my vote to any candidate I want to. I'm not obliged to give my vote to any particular candidate. And in the Democratic Party, this is similar in the Republican Party as well. If, you know, you run as a delegate for a candidate. So in Maryland, for example, or even in D.C., you would run as a Hillary Clinton delegate. And if you were elected, then you're required to vote for Hillary Clinton on the first ballot that goes down at the convention. After that, if there's no clear winner, you can switch your vote. But superdelegates can vote for whoever they want, and they can vote whenever they want. They can give their support to a candidate. You don't have to wait till the primary. We could all on the first day go for a candidate if we wanted to. So, given that entire setup with delegates, the picture's changed slightly for us. And I want to talk about how what we think of the Democratic candidates. That's one thing I want to talk about tonight because there's so many of them.
Well, and it's looking more like the Republican landscape did last time around when there were 16, which was unheard of, right? So it's now we have precedents. But you do not have any Republicans signed on the statehood, right?
No, not one, not yet.
Okay. So I just wanted to, it's interesting how it falls under party lines, and I understand why. Because your population is less than a million, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I know that people say, well, then if you get 2 cents, but there are states that have smaller populations than the District of Columbia.
Two states currently have smaller populations, and at one time there were 6 states with smaller populations. The population of the District of Columbia at one time was 875,000. It's now 702,000 and growing every day. So, there's 2 states now, Vermont and Wyoming, that both have senators and 2 senators, and they're smaller populations. And there's 22 states, believe it or not, there are 22 states with smaller GNP or gross product, domestic product, as the District of Columbia. We have more money than 22 states. So we're big enough to be a state. When they formed the government, they wanted to make it easy to become a state. So the bar is set pretty low. I mean, you have to have a population of 50,000, I think, to apply for statehood. So obviously, we're way above that threshold, and we're probably larger than the original 13 states. You know, every state that came in originally. So, some people say we're too small in land. Area, but you know that we would be the smallest state and land area, but that's ridiculous, and that's why, because if it was about land area, California would have 23 senators, and Rhode Island would have one. You know, that's why you have so many. You know, because population is the what we use in the House to decide on representation.
Right.
Every 10 years we do a census, and that's readjusted. And so that's why you have so many representatives in California and New York, and, you know, what we call the Sacred 11. And that's, you know, I've got to tell you, for the first time, and I think it's because the Democrats got beaten by the Electoral College last time. There was talk. I just spent the last 3 days at meetings of the Democratic National Committee. And let me explain that the Democratic National Committee, which runs what we generally call the National Democratic Party, is made up of delegates all across the country, about 4,000 delegates or members. And there was talk about changing the Electoral College. I've never heard serious talk about that, because, you know, we call them the Sacred 11. There are 11 states that if you win those 11 states, you can lose the other 39 and still become president.
Because of the Electoral College.
Yeah, because of the Electoral College. Because, you know, you have to win California, New York, Illinois, Texas, Indiana, Ohio, Florida, all the big states, all the states with big populations, and all you have to do is win 11 of them. And if you know, theoretically, I don't think anybody's ever done that, but just won those 11. But theoretically, if you win those 11, that's it. You're in the door. So there was talk about that at the meeting, and, you know, let's start there tonight, if you don't mind talking. Let me tell you a little bit some of the concerns I have after listening to Democrats for 3 days. My largest concern is that they seem very focused on the process. Like I said, the Electoral College, redistricting, you know, getting people in, getting the right candidates in the right places. And if I can use a football analogy, because I know you're a Rams fan, you know, I think if you're going to, when you go into a contest, and that's what an election is, you can look at as many game films as you want in football, and you can try to figure out all the weaknesses of the other team. And teams do this. But I think the people that win the game are the people that focus on their strategy and the power of their players and making sure that they're executing properly. That's my fear after 3 days with Democrats. They're not looking at why people didn't vote for us last time. You know, they're looking at the process and how we can best use the process. And I think they need to address some of the issues that where they've lost touch with America. And I don't see them doing that, and that worries me.
Well, it's interesting, though, because in theory, it's not who didn't vote for the Democrat. It's who didn't vote, period, or who did vote for Trump.
Right.
And right. I don't know that what your party offers would provide anybody who did vote for Trump to go across the aisle. So I don't know that that's the solution. I think probably getting out the vote, which you guys are usually pretty good about, at least President Obama was, galvanizing and electrifying and getting people to register to vote and then to showing up to vote, that seems to be your strength. Because you've got the numbers also.
Well, that's right. That's right. If all the Republicans vote for the Republican candidate and all the Democrats vote for the Democratic candidate, the Democrat always wins because right. there's more Democrats than there are Republicans.
Right.
But we all go for that middle ground, right? Because mm-hmm. there's some Republicans that wouldn't vote for a Democrat regardless of who he was and or she was, and vice versa, right? They're mm-hmm. they're always going to vote because they
the party see, line,
right? And they see the parties as having different agendas, which is true, and they vote the party line. So you know, we used to call them yellow dog Democrats because some Texas Democrat once said, "I'd vote for a yellow dog if it was a Democrat." Mm-hmm. You know, there's a certain amount of people that are always going to vote the party line, but we're always going for those people in the middle because those are the people that decide the elections. In
so
every
are they in the middle or are they the Gray Panthers?
Well, I don't know who, you know, there's certainly, in my opinion, a conglomeration of different groups, and they change, right? They change, right? Because
well, that's why President Obama was so electrifying, because he did get people, one, to register to vote or right. to vote, and I believe he also got people to step across the aisle because of who he was, what he represented, what it meant to our country historically, and all of those other things.
Well, you know, and those things change. That group in the middle changes over time because, you know, just look at the parties, for example. It's always bothered me as a Christian that Democrats have lost Christianity somehow. They've lost, you know, for some reason, Christ is a Republican. I've never quite been able to figure that out. But you could say the same thing about Republicans. You know, a little further back, who was the Great Emancipator? The Great Emancipator wasn't a Democrat. It was Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. By the way, President Lincoln, happy birthday. And President Washington, I'm sorry that we now group you together when you used to each have your own holiday. But Lincoln was the Great Emancipator, right? And I go out a lot of times and I lecture about civil rights and I talk about the Republican, Dr. Martin Luther King. And lots of young people go, no. Martin Luther King was a Democrat. No, he was a Republican. And if you study the history of the civil rights movement in the South, you'll realize that a lot of the people that supported segregation in the South were elected Democrats. They were like, in fact, the Republicans could so not get elected in places in the South that they changed the name of their party and called themselves Dixiecrats so that they could get, you know, in certain places like Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi. So, you know, and now the Democratic Party is the party of civil rights and the Republican Party is not the party of civil rights. So that group in the middle changes, the parties themselves change. And this is, you know, I guess what I'm talking about, working class people used to be Democrats. What happened?
Well, which brings me to the candidate Julian Castro from Texas.
Yeah.
I mean, so his grandmother, I guess, was the immigrant from Mexico. And then he has his degree, his bachelor's from Stanford and his law degree from Harvard. And he was elected mayor of San Antonio at the age of 35. And I think he's 44 years old now or something. I mean, he's got a twin brother who's in the House of Representatives. And his mother founded La Raza Unida, Maria by the way. And I'm thinking, with the Hispanic vote mattering more now and them being more registered Democrats, even though I do think the Republican Party actually represents them more than they may realize, and this whole immigration thing and the wall and stuff like that, who better? Do you see somebody more sexy and exciting than him?
Well, you know what? If you're talking about a sleeper candidate who's like President Obama was, he's, you know, he's certainly the guy, I think. When we were, one other thing I want to add about him is that he was one of the keynote speakers at the convention in Charlotte in 2014, and he's all that anybody talked about. And after he gave his keynote speech, and I should point out that the keynote speaker in Atlanta in 1988, who gave the most terrible speech I've ever heard, was the governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton. And in fact, my cousin, who's from Georgia, and they, you know, they don't like anybody else, in, or he doesn't like anybody else in the South, said to me, "Who is this guy?" And I said, "He's the governor of Arkansas." And he goes, "Oh, that explains it." But you know, of course, Clinton became a great orator after that. But he was the keynote speaker, and then Obama was the keynote speaker in Boston. So being the keynote speaker is not a bad thing in the Democratic Party, and he's very charismatic. He's handsome. He's I think if he's if you're talking about, is there an Obama candidate out there? You know, a guy that came from, is going to come from the back of the pack, as Obama did, right? He was a one-term senator from Illinois. Julian Castro is a really good pick. I really think that he's one of the sleepers out there. Now there's
just to go back to the Latino thing, I always call Hispanic, I identify as Hispanic, so I don't know if Latino refers more to Central and South America, whereas Hispanic, I think, is like all kinds of Spanish-speaking people, you know, including Spain. But, you know, it's California, Texas, and Nevada having inordinately large populations of Latinos who are Democrats. And you just mentioned the Sacred 11. So, especially California and Texas, you want to talk about populace, right?
Yeah, well, I think he's got some advantages there. Now, he's got some hurdles to overcome in terms of, he's up against a lot of establishment candidates. I mean, look, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 candidates from the United States Senate who have already declared. You know, you've got Klobuchar from Minnesota, and Harris from California, and Warren, and Gillibrand, and Booker, and Brown from Ohio. So that's some pretty, you know, that's a pretty tough mountain to climb. And
we don't have Bernie or Biden yet.
You don't have Bernie or Biden. And you don't have Bloomberg, and you don't have, you know, they're talking about other people out there too. Eric Holder. I mean, there's a whole group of people, and they may show up too. And Biden, of course, is polling as the second highest person in the Democratic Party, right behind Kamala Harris. So there's still a lot of people to come. And I worry about this, again, because I was involved in the campaign. I've been involved in many campaigns, but I represented one of the seven dwarfs. And back in 1988, there were seven candidates in the Democratic Party. And there were people like Jesse Jackson and Dick Gephardt and Paul Simon and Al Gore and Gary Hart. And anyway, there were seven of them. And we ended up with Michael Dukakis. And Michael Dukakis was not a very strong candidate.
Yeah.
So he got beaten. I think the same thing happened to the Republicans last time. I think they ended up with a candidate that they wouldn't otherwise have had. Now, Trump proved to be a strong candidate. He wasn't a weak candidate. But I think that he surprised the establishment. I mean, look, he was up against some pretty experienced and ensconced Republicans with no... You know, the guy had never even been elected to the head of his condo association.
Right.
You know, so here was a guy that was, you couldn't be any more outside than he was. And that's another factor I think we have to take into consideration.
Well, which brings in Howard Schultz, right?
Howard Schultz, who so far has come up with the greatest slogan, right? Make America Grande Again. you've got people like that. And who else were they talking about? I mean, it's getting to be a blur because there's so many people involved. But you have a lot of candidates who may come in from, you know, kind of, I don't want to call them fringe candidates, but outside of politics. And look, you know, if you want to talk about Trump being an outsider and kind of a fringe candidate, how about we have the same thing going on the Democratic side, right? With Ocasio-Cortez, the newly elected congresswoman from New York.
I cannot believe her mouth. I normally stay away from the day-to-day stuff because I just like to get the overview, you know, whatever the Associated Press says or Reuters says or your Washington Post or the New York Times. And I was with my mother, and she is an avid cable news watcher. And that woman was everywhere, off every program, not as a guest, but just snippets or quotes or both pro and con. But it's like, what is it about her? Because she's young, because she's a newbie, because she's mixed race, because she's from New York, that they can't stay away from her.
No, I think it's the same thing that about Trump, that she's an outsider, that she's in a sense, you know, that she's young, she hasn't been elected. Look at what she said about this Amazon deal. And there, you know, now she looks like the great giant killer, right? You know, she's the David of the Democratic Party. She drove Amazon out of New York City. Out of Long Island. But, you know, she said, we can use that $3 billion. We can use that $3 billion to create jobs, to, you know, do everything that Amazon promised to do. Except there is no $3 billion.
Right. I know.
You know,
that's the thing.
You know, like, what I mean? But
the thing she comes out of her mouth is ridiculous.
Well, you know, but the things that appeal to people when they don't think about it, Maria, you know, one of my favorites has always been conservative politicians who say it's your tax money and you should be able to spend it. So we're going to return it to the local governments. You know what? Local governments are considerably more corrupt than the federal government. Now, the federal government might waste money, but local governments, you know, that's where your Uncle Charlie gets the paving contract, right? It's very hard to do that at the federal level because it's bigger and more complex, and you know what I mean? But on the surface, it seems to make sense to people. And I think that's the same thing here. The $3 billion, they're going, yeah, well, $3 billion, you could create a lot of jobs. Yeah, except there's no $3
billion
there. Yeah, exactly. It was in lieu of them paying. So really, they didn't gain $3 billion. They lost $24 billion. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I see about this woman. Is she's naive. You know, she needs to be out there for a while. We, by the way, have invited her on the show formally. We invited her when she first got elected. So we haven't heard back from her. But I think now that she's on CNN and everywhere else, we might have a hard time getting her.
I would just think, and I know that President Trump has said things that people doubt and the fact checkers do. And they, you know, they say it's partial truth or it is an outright misstatement or what have you. But at least he's got the office of president behind him and hopefully advisors that do have his ear. I would think she should keep her mouth shut and learn and then make statements that are have veracity and are informed and have been fact-checked so that people, because she's got such a spotlight, make sure that what you say is worth being heard.
Well, that's because you're Maria Sanchez, and that's one, and that's one of the reasons that you're not president, because you're certainly smart enough and accomplished enough to run for the office. But, you know, if I was her political advisor, I'd say, you're doing it right, girl, because she is on all the TV stations, and she is, you know, and let's be honest about the president. He doesn't bend the truth. He bends the truth every damn day of his life. So there's no downside to it in seemingly if your goal is to get ahead in politics. If your goal is to be honest and forthright and make America a better place, I think that what you say is very valid. But I think if you wanna get ahead in politics, that's not, unfortunately, not necessarily true.
That's a terrible statement.
It is. It's a terrible statement. And it's a terrible, when the country was formed, this is directly impacts what I do. The reason that the District of Columbia doesn't have a vote is because when the country was formed, the people that put it together, the guys we call the framers of the Constitution, they didn't know how popular government was going to work. They weren't sure that you should give a vote to uneducated people. They weren't sure that people that we were an agrarian society, they thought you needed to own land. Why should you have a say in the government if you don't own land? You don't have a stake in the game, you know? And even though we modified that to include people, we realized that inclusiveness is better. There's also a little bit of truth to it, isn't there? That if you're going to be in a democracy and you're going to be a good voter, you need to be an informed voter, right? You need to know what's going on a little bit.
Well, here's what I have to say about that. Ideally, that's correct. But the truth is, our population is dominated by all different kinds of factions. So some people are ignorant. Some people are uneducated. Some people are stupid. Some people are illiterate. And they still represent the United States of America. And I don't mean any one of those categories to sound pejorative. I'm just trying to give an assessment that we're not all white collar, college educated, you know, earn $100K, have a mortgage, send our kids to private school people. That's not who America is. We're a whole bunch of things. So I hear what you say, because I think an informed voter is a better voter. But I also know that that's not what our population is comprised of.
Right. Well, and you know what? As my friend Al Einstein said, you know, if I had three or four things that I had to pass on to my children to live by, one of them would be especially politically, what Einstein said, that what you see depends on where you stand. So, I don't think there are different versions of the truth, but where I stand and where you stand makes a difference in the way we see things. And so,
which has to do with perspective.
Right. And what's
important to us. And how long we've been on this planet.
Yes. And what's important to us. You know what? I don't want to build a wall. I think a wall is a ridiculous thing to build. I think it's a bad symbolism, and that it's going to be ineffective. But you know what? I have friends that live on the border, and I hear from them, and they are distressed, and they don't feel the same way I do because I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., right, where, you know, the only reason we want to build a wall is to keep Maryland and Virginia drivers out of our city. But other than that, but in all seriousness, they see the crisis from a totally different point of view. And so what's important to them and what's important to me are two different things. And that's, again, was a scary thing about the Democrats, because the statement you just made about people were not all white collar, college educated, that unfortunately I think is something that Democrats have lost touch with, you know, that we don't want to tell you, you don't really want a gun. You know, you're just too damn stupid to realize it, and we're going to explain to you why you don't want it. Rather than sitting down and talking to people and trying to work it out. You know what I mean? We're right. We're smarter than you are. And right. I think that's one thing that people really resent about the Democratic Party, and we really need to change that. And you know what? I want to listen, and I encourage all our listeners to go out tomorrow night and listen to, I think she's on CNN, Senator Klobuchar, as she announces. But I heard a little snippet where she says, we have to take our country back. I'm sorry. I think we need to bring our country together. You know, and it's funny that I've been thinking for a long time about this. As I said at the onset, this was one of the reasons for the show. And I thought, you know, our slogan should really be "Make America Whole Again." And I was talking to Deborah Emerson, who does the PR for our show, the other day, and she said the same thing to me. She said, "You know what? We need the slogan Make America Whole Again." And I think that's true. And I think the Democrats are ignoring that. I think they're not looking at it from that.
When were we whole?
Well, I think we were whole. I think there were issues. You know, there's always been a divide. But you know what? We were whole during the Second World War. You know, there wasn't, you know, I was raised during the Vietnam era, and we all went out and protested that war. But you know what? Our dads all put on their helmets and boots and went over to Europe, right? They all stood up for America. When I was a kid, there was a thing, you know, I think we were all, there was a common bond that we all have that I don't know that we have anymore. Do you think we still have that bond? Do you not feel I don't stand up and put my hand over my heart when they play the national anthem or we say the Pledge of Allegiance because I'm a politician and I know that's the right thing to do. I do it because I'm proud to be an American. And I think that there was a time when most of us were proud to be Americans, and I'm not sure that's true anymore.
And I think there has always been differences, which has made our country great. But how we disagreed is what has changed.
Yes.
That the social etiquette we once observed and respected is what is making us look more divisive than I think we really are. And it's bad behavior. I was just having this conversation yesterday that, you know, I mean, wearing ball caps during the anthems, for example,
yes,
or into a 5-star restaurant,
yes,
or jeans with holes in them, or T-shirts with holes in them, that would never, ever have been seen, I don't think, even 20 years ago. And now it passes as okay. Forget gauges and piercings and tattoos, because body art and all of that, I think, is a different story. I don't think that's disrespectful. I think that's an expression. But when you choose to put a ball cap, it doesn't just fall onto your head. And when you choose not to take it off out of respect for our country, that never would have happened before. And now it's commonplace.
Well, and you know what? I'm not sure that I agree with you that it's disrespect. It bothers the hell out of me, too. I think that to some extent, for younger people, they just don't get it. They don't understand that they're being disrespectful. Maybe some of them do understand they're being disrespectful, but I think a lot of them don't understand they're being disrespectful. I mean, it drives me crazy too, Maria. I go into a restaurant and I see all these people sitting, all these men sitting there with ball caps. And, you know, I think about, I go to mass sometimes with my brother in the Catholic church. And I was raised a Catholic, and I see kids, you know, people in flip-flops and t-shirts. And I think to myself, oh, my mother, oh my God, she would have just flipped out. Yeah. If I came down in a pair of short pants to go to church, or, you know, I could have a tie and a jacket on and short pants, and she would have made me change. You know, when I was a kid, actually, when I was in, I remember this very distinctly, when I was in middle school, the big thing was to wear, you know, these what we call mats, work pants, and these band-on shirts. Well, my mother didn't let me go to school without a shirt with a collar on. Mm-hmm. I couldn't wear tennis shoes. So, and I went to a public school. So I used to hide the stuff in my brother's car. We didn't have backpacks in those days. I don't know when they invented the backpack, but I used to marvel when my kids were little. They would have so much in their backpack, I was afraid they would tip over.
They fall backwards.
Yeah, but you know, I hide the stuff in my brother's car and change.
Church and attire. Part of me understands it because this is a house of God and this is a place of worship. And the other part of me is, thank goodness you're here, and whatever you want to wear works for me because you're here to celebrate whatever, you know, whatever God you may believe in or entity or spirit. So I do go back and forth with that one because, yeah, it's like, oh, come on. You know, you had a choice and you chose flip-flops. But on the other hand, you had a choice and you're here.
Well, you know, and who do we blame for this when we talk about this? Who do we blame? Do we blame, like the ball cap thing, do we blame that on the feminist movement? Because now men and women are equal, and women have always been able to wear hats indoors. You know, in fact, my mother used to carry, you weren't allowed in the Catholic Church as a woman without something on your head.
Covering your head, right.
Right. So she always, you know, she would carry like a handkerchief and bobby pins in her purse in case she wanted, you know, in case she needed to go into church and pray for my soul in an emergency situation, and she would be prepared. So I'm not even sure, but I think we need to, you know, and those are customs, but you're right. They, you know, there's also a thing, there's also an element of respect. When you hold a door open for somebody, or you say thank you or excuse me, that's another pet peeve I have. Excuse me. Excuse me used to be a term you used for inconveniencing someone. I stepped in front of you. Excuse me.
Yes.
Now, right, now it means get the hell out of the way.
Exactly. Excuse me.
Excuse me. Yeah, exactly. You know, and I'm not sure, but I think there needs to be some, you know, I don't want to go.
Well, back. We've had her twice on our program, Jules Hurst Martinez, who's an etiquette expert. And I would think her world, it would be terrible because, I mean, she goes from everything about how to set a table to how to whom do you introduce to whom first, depending on title and stature and things. And most people are like, hey, this is George. Hey, that's Mike, you know, and that's the extent of it. Because I would think that her world must be crashing with how we don't pay attention to protocol and to tradition and to respect. And I mean, Michael, I stand up when I'm introduced to somebody. If I'm seated, I just do that out of respect. The fact that my grandfather used to do it when anybody entered the room, I'll never forget. I remember looking at him when he would do it at the time and thinking, wonder what's that about? And then slowly I realized he was showing respect. You know, even though he was most likely the elder in the room because he was my grandpa, right?
Yeah.
Or Opa, as we called him. But that's what I don't get, because when you say the feminist movement, I chafe at that because I hold the door open for whomever is behind me. I don't care what their gender or what their age is. It's just common courtesy. I don't think it's a male-female thing. I don't think it's a inequity in terms of relationship or responsibility or roles. I just think it's human nature and it's basic common decency.
I didn't mean it in those terms. I mean, I think that, you know, like my dad used to say, there was an upside and a downside to everything. And there's certainly an upside to the changes that have occurred in our society for women and minorities and, you know, and lots of other people. But maybe part of the downside, too, in the progress that we've made is that we've forgotten some of these traditions which do reflect on, you know, how we treat each other. Like, you know, I got to tell you, I can, if there's one woman standing up on the metro, I can't sit down when I take it. And if I offer her my seat and she doesn't take it, I still can't sit down. And that was in, and that's a matter of respect. And that was imprinted on me when I was a child by my grandmother. You know, I've told this story very many times on the show that, you know, when I was a little boy, my grandmother used to, we took the bus everywhere. My grandmother used to make me go offer my seat to any woman that was standing up. And I was so little, I remember this at 5 or 6 years old, that women would always look at me and with astonishment and say, oh, no, that's okay, honey. Thank you, but that's okay, you know, because who's going to take a seat from a child that small? But I would have to say to him, you don't understand. I can't go back. Right. I can't go back. My grandmother won't let me go back. If I come back and say she doesn't want the seat, my grandmother pushed me back out in the aisle and say, go convince her. You know,
well, therein lies the rub, though, Michael, because that means kids don't know that stuff innately. So somebody has dropped the ball in raising our children to default. And I'm not saying you and I are correct, because I know we agree on this. But I also think it doesn't hurt for you to default to common courtesy. You know, you're not going to lose out if you do that, for whatever your motivation is. If it's because you want to be popular, or you want to be well-liked, or you want to be respected, or you want to be promoted, or what have you, or you just want to be a decent human being, you can't go bad or wrong by doing that. So why we haven't insisted that the next generation understand that, I'm not quite sure. But I think it has to do, too, with my generation dropped the salutation with the pronoun as to describe who they were talking to, Mr., Mrs., Doctor, Sir, Ma'am, what have you.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's okay. It's just that my generation didn't want that, because it was, I think, probably from the free love thing, like, you know, we're all equal. And
right.
But I used to resent a 3-year-old looking up at me and calling me Maria. No, I'm not Maria. No, I'm not. Not to you.
Oh, yeah. Well, we fought with our kids. But, you know, I remember one of the more popular moms, a wonderful woman who we adored, who was a lawyer, a very accomplished government lawyer. And all the girls called her by her first name. And I would fight with my daughter and I'd say, I don't give a damn if she's okay with it and you're okay with it. I'm not okay with it. Mm-hmm. Okay. She's Mrs. Mm-hmm. You know, she's not your pal. Her daughter is your pal.
Right.
You know, and where it's perfectly fine for her to call you Trisha, it's not, you know,
vice versa.
Yeah. Right. You can't just use that.
How powerful, though, coming from a man to say that, because being a single mom, I was the one that did that with my kids, and having 3 sons, they listened to me because it was my way or the highway. I ruled with an iron fist. But I can't imagine how more powerful it would have been if their father had made that important to them.
Well, you know what? Unfortunately, my kids figured out after a while that I was more bluster than I was, you know. I never figured that out with my dad. My dad used to say, you know, outrageous things to us, like, I'll rip your arm off and beat you to death with a with a bloody stump. Yeah. But and we always believed he would. Uh-huh. And then one day when I got older, I thought to myself, you know, he really never put his hands on us. I don't know. He was just very convincing, you know, that we never doubted they would do that. Well, I want to say to our listeners, it's time to go. And I'm proud of the fact that we are one of the few shows in America that deals with politics that did not talk about the emergency shutdown, the national emergency, or the government shutdown that's been avoided. But we're saving those topics for next week and other things about national politics for next week to talk with our very, very special guest, Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele, who's just an amazing guy and will be a really great guest. And we hope you'll tune in next week. And I want to leave you today. I grew up listening to a local musician named Nils Lofgren, who has for many years been the lead guitarist for Bruce Springsteen. But before he got there, he had a group called Grin, and they did a song called We All Sung Together. And I want to play that song as we leave tonight, because this is the important thing, right? We do all sing together. We're all here at the same place in the same time. We won't, you know, that changes. But while we're here, I think we need to cooperate with each other to make a better world. I really believe that.
Yes. No, that's a difficult point for anybody to argue with, I would say. And we thank our listeners, as always, for making us a part of your week. We appreciate it.
And anybody out there that feels like they want to start a writing campaign for Maria Sanchez for president, please do, because I think she'd be great.
You're silly.
Okay, folks. We'll see you next week.
A great week. Looking forward to our guest, too.
Yeah.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.